Bonjour, ou oh, bonsoir. Je veux m'excuser parce que ce soir, je ne parlerai pas sur le sujet dans le programme, cybercommunisme, mais sur le premier chapitre d'un livre qui est un remix de l'article cybercommunisme sur le futur imaginaire. And now I'm going to switch into English. Protest. If my horrible accent stops you from understanding. Okay, I'm just going to talk quickly through something which for me is, as I said, comes from, you know, it says in the program that I'm talking about cyber communism. A few years ago, I wrote this article basically because I was invited to New York to a conference in the middle of the dot-com bubble and was asked to make a provocative statement. And I thought the good thing would be to go to America at the height of the enthusiasm for selling shares and having IPOs and launching your new company and say, America has invented the only working model of communism in human history. It's called the Internet. And this was sort of reasonably successful, at least annoying some people, particularly among the free software movement who didn't like to be identified on the left. And then I got thinking about this and so thought about how the way that we talk about futures today is often informed by how people thought about futures in the past. And I thought the first and most interesting one to start off with would be to look at the future of artificial intelligence. Because artificial intelligence is one of those things that we know. So if people say to you, you know, thinking machines, the sentient computer, you know what they mean because we were brought up with it. As you can see, we, you know, we have data from Star Trek and lots of other science fiction films. And also we have companies like Honda, for instance, with the Azimo robot, which they've just launched, claiming that you can produce a machine that will look after, you know, the old age pensioners, run the factories. We know what this means. And what's more, there are people who actually see this as not just as a sort of scientific or a business quest, but actually as a sort of spiritual thing, that they want to create the first coming of the Silicon Messiah, particularly, of course, in the west coast of California. You have people like Ray Kurzweil, the guy who was in the quote on the previous slide, who thinks that if you exponentially increase the power of hardware and have better and better software, eventually computers will reach the stage where they will become intelligent, where they will even have emotions. They will become better than us. They will become the super being. And I think what we have to think, so what I want to do today is just talk a bit about a way this is a long historical process, but also the way that we think about, say, something like artificial intelligence gives us an idea about how we think about the future in general. And this sort of connects back to concepts like cyber communism, which is a way of playing with this view about futures and how we understand them and how they shape our society. So I just want to take you back 40 years to when the largest computer company in the world put on an exhibition in New York, which is the world's financial center of the world's greatest power. Now, at this exhibition, as you can see here, rotating around, the giant corporations of America put on a show combining, you know, hucksterism and patriotism. Here we have the symbol of the fair, which is the Unisphere, which shows obviously that America owns the world in conjunction with its brother enemy, the Russians. Various people like here we have the rubber tire, which is actually a funfair wheel, and so on and so forth. Now, these shows were very impressive, and one of the reasons that I'm interested in this, because actually I was there. So here we have, I'm the little boy on the right with the white socks. That's my mother looking incredibly glamorous. If you can't really see, she's got some very funky slingbacks on. And that's my sister looking very pissed off because it's 30 degrees and she's getting, you know, she's only four and wanting another ice cream. So I actually had to ring my mother up because I couldn't actually remember when I was doing the research on this whether I'd actually been or just seen enough imagery at the time because we were living in America in that year, 64, 65. And because what I could remember about it was the technology. I could. The thing that I remembered and what actually hit people at the time at the World's Fair was the technology that was on show, and what made the World's Fair was the technology. And what, in particular, not just, as I said, I showed you those corporate exhibitions which showed things like, you know, plastic clothes or the latest washing machine or Parker pens, where you could communicate with writing upside down to people or whatever. But what they did show is three key technologies, which are the stars of the show. And the first thing, which is the thing I remember, the only thing I can remember as a seven-year-old of it, was in fact the NASA Space Park. If you were a little boy in 1964, particularly one who was living in America, you knew all the names of the American astronauts and would watch these things on television. You can see in the middle, it's the Mercury spacecraft. This is the rocket that took the first American into space. The little capsule on the left is the Gemini spacecraft. And the thing on the right-hand side is the bottom of the rocket, which would then take the first Americans to the moon. The only people who have been to the moon are Americans. What we have to remember at that time is the way that we understood this technology was not just what you saw on the field, but on this NASA space part, but that it was a prototype of what was to come. And we understood the future through what we saw on the field of the NASA space park. That is, these rockets are prototypes of what we see from 2001, which is these interplanetary space liners. We were promised in the General Motors Futurama exhibition that we would be holidaying on the moon by 1980. I mean, I know now that Richard Branson is promising to send people for 4 minutes of weightlessness for $210,000 in about 4 years' time. But we were supposed to be able to go on package holidays to the Sea of Tranquility 20 years ago. And this, again, in 1968, took obviously in 2001, it actually showed you what this would be. So we're seeing the present through the future and understanding the present through the future. Another example of something that was on show and was very successful at the Great Exhibition, the World's Fair, was in fact this demonstration of free energy. This was the first public exhibition of fusion power. General Electric was a company that sold fission nuclear reactors, and it was now showing you how in a few years' time, by 1980 at the latest probably, we would actually have free energy, unmetered electricity. But of course, the thing that we're interested in, I think, for us, is to actually think about the third of the technologies that was on show and was very successful, which was that of the computer. Now, IBM put on this this egg-shaped thing. It's designed by the Finnish architect Eero Saarinen. This is a theater in the egg. As you can see, it's embossed with the IBM logo outside, and it's actually held up on a whole series of metal trees. And underneath these trees are exhibits which tell you about the computer. They obviously spent a lot of money on this. This was the most successful and popular exhibition in the show, though I must admit at seven I wasn't that interested in computers, so I didn't go to it. Or if I did, I don't remember it. The reason why they spent so much money, is because they just launched the System 360. Now, this mainframe was the first modular computer system, so you could actually have different types of a mainframe, from a sort of small one to a big one. It was compatible with printers and with storage devices. It was a first modular computer system. And the architecture, the hardware architecture of this, according to a friend of mine, is actually basically what our modern PCs and laptops are based upon. Now, this, as I said, was a promotional device. So that this exhibition, which the spaceships they put on, was designed to promote their new product. But when people came to this exhibit, they knew actually what they were going to see, which was not necessarily this hardware on show, but they understood it actually through the common science fiction ideas of the period, which were this idea of Robbie the Robot, which I gather very appropriately you're showing in a few days' time. 1958 classic Forbidden Planet, which shows that what artificial intelligence is the friendly robot servant, the person who will look after you. And as you can see by the quote at the bottom, was by a major management theorist of the period, Herbert Simon, they were predicting that within a decade that you would be able to have a computer that that has the same capabilities of the human brain. And by, I mean, within a decade, this means by 1970, we would be this sort of thing, this mainframe, would become this, Robbie the robot. In other words, the way you understood the mainframe was that it was the prototype of the robot servant, and that the robot servant showed you what the mainframe was today. Now, in the exhibit, the centre of the exhibit, which was this, if you remember, this thing that looks like the egg here, what was inside it was, in fact, a theatre. And as you can see, you went and got onto this thing called the people wall, and then you were elevated up inside the egg, where you were shown a multimedia display. What we call new media art these days, because it was actually put on by Charles and Ray Eames, who were, you know, the epitome of American modernist design at the period. And as you can see from this thing, see, you came in up, you were elevated upwards inside the egg. This is the announcer who was lowered down from the ceiling, and here is the multimedia show. And what this this show, was, which was called The Information Machine, demonstrated or tried to explain to you, is that the computer, this thing that you saw here, yeah, was actually worked in the same way as the human brain. And therefore, in prototype, it was this, the artificial robot servant, the thing that you would be able to buy in a few years' time and would look after you and serve you well. And so when we look at this idea, we have to think about what they're trying to say to us. This, as I said, is a way of the imaginary future. And to understand this, this is not just advertising hype. This is not just a way of selling their new machines to corporate and military customers. It's also a way that the IBM itself genuinely saw the machines that it was creating. So to think about this, I think we need to go back yet again to understand at the beginning of these exhibitions, to understand what their purpose was and how this concept of imaginary futures was a way that not only was used, as I said, as advertising hype, but actually was a way that people who were involved in making these new technologies understood how they themselves were doing. So I want to go back to, in fact, the first ever World's Fair, which is the great exhibition of the works of industry of all nations, held in 1851 in Hyde Park in London. And in the middle of the 19th century, England, or the British Empire, was like America was in the 1960s. I mean, in the early 1960s, America was at the peak of its power. It had half the world's gross national product and was the dominant military, financial, technological, cultural power. And similarly, England in the middle of the 19th century was the same. It had half the world's gross national product, the Royal Navy ruled the seas, and it intervened around the world to create and determine what was going on, like inventing Belgium, of course, let us not forget, in the 1830s. The Crystal Palace in Hyde Park is the world's first ever modern building made out of steel and glass, and inside it shows off exhibits of the goods being made by the world's first industrial revolution and the countries that are imitating what the English are doing. And, of course, at this exhibition, like in 1964 in New York, the stars of the show were new technology. In the 1850s, the great technology was that of steam and telegraphy. And in particular, if you think of the things like railway trains were the things that allowed people to come to the Great Exhibition. 1/6 of the entire English population went to the Great Exhibition. And the reason was because the new technology of railways allowed people to come from far away to visit the exhibition. And of course, at the centre of it are these machines that make cotton. The cotton industry is the leading edge of the Industrial Revolution. But, of course, if you look at this picture with all these Victorians admiring this machine, of course, what's noticeable is there's no workers there. This is a factory without workers. And this is because the Great Exhibition exacerbates one of the things that obviously is general under capitalism. That is that we see goods and commodities, but we don't see the labour behind them. You know, we can see behind... This is what Marx calls commodity fetishism. And if you look at this cartoon from Punch magazine, actually at the time of the Great Exhibition, what it's saying is that when you look at the silk dresses, which were very successful among the female visitors, of course what you don't see is the needlewoman who's working 12 hours a day in a garret making it. Or at the back they have somebody, it says a labourer age 75, the people who have to work on in the, you know, until way past their pensionable age, or this guy on the right who is a sweater, which again is somebody who's been worked to death basically by making the commodities. So the commodities which are on show don't show the labour behind them. But what we have to think about in the Great Exhibition is that these goods are not only on show, but they actually don't even have a price. So they're not only it's not just the use value, the way that the use value was created, it was hidden. Even their exchange value is not explicit. This is what German Marxist Walter Benjamin, of course, calls exhibition value. As he says, what they take is a purely ideological role. And so we can see that the way machinery operates here, machinery both makes use values, that is, makes cotton, which you can then wear and put on your bed and do the rest of it, but it also can be sold, and on turn in this case it can be actually displayed to actually show that what this technology means is that it's a symbol of how the future is being created, because both bourgeois liberals and working class socialists could see in these machines a confirmation of what the future would be, either as a liberal market economy or as a socialist high-tech republic. Now, but actually what's interesting, at the centre of the Great Exhibition here was not, though the machinery was the most successful exhibit, actually the centre of the exhibit was something quite different, was not machinery, as in 1964 in New York, but in fact a display of Gothic Revival furniture. And this is because in the middle of the 19th century, the British elite were a bit worried about the consequences of the Industrial Revolution. So what they liked to do is actually hide new high-tech inventions like railways. As you can see, this is St. Pancras Station with its nice Crystal Palace-style roof. But what they did, you know, as you see, they can see exactly the same, but it has these sort of nice medieval features even on the concourse. This is where we're going outside, another bit of nice steel and glass architecture, but the front of it looks like a medieval Italian palace. This is what Eric Hobsbawm calls an invented tradition. And so England was very good in the 19th century at disguising the fact that it was a high-tech commercial republic by pretending to be a romantic medieval monarchy. And you can see this in our Houses of Parliament, you can see it in places like Tower Bridge, or you can see it in the whole British Constitution with all this, House of Lords and Sir this and Lord that and the Queen and the rest of it. But actually behind it, of course, is this first modern nation. And this is, as I said, this is invented tradition, but actually most subsequent exhibitions that came after the Great Exhibition actually didn't go towards this idea of hiding technology with the past, but actually doing the reverse, doing what I showed you in 1964, which is actually to say that the present shouldn't be understood through the past, but the present should be understood as a prototype of the future. There were great exhibitions almost immediately after the 1851 in London, in Paris and New York and so on. So, and of course, the most famous, you know, landmark of the late 19th century, of course, is that of the 1889 Paris exhibition, which is the Eiffel Tower. And by the middle of the 20th century, we get another exhibition actually held roughly in the same space as the previous one, which is the Paris International Exhibition of 1937, where you can see the symbol of French republicanism from the late 19th century. But on the left and the right here, you can see symbols of two totalitarian imaginary futures. On the left-hand side is Albert Speer's pavilion for the Nazi Third Reich, as you can see with the horrible eagle on the front. And then on the right is, in fact, Stalinist Russia's Ek Pavilion with the famous Mukina statue of the worker and collective farm labourer, which is still in Moscow, of course. So this is, you know, this is what Europe had become but in the middle of the 20th century, which was divided between these two rival totalitarian imaginary futures, which would rip the continent apart and end in war, Holocaust, and partition between two superpowers. In contrast, 2 years later in America, a different imaginary future was offered in New York. And this is the exhibition... this is Futurama, the General Motors exhibition, and the other one, this again shows a shop from inside it, and there's another one called Democracy City, and these were showing a different future. Rather than a totalitarian militarist, this is Democracy City here, and they're both, these were dioramas showing America as a car-owning, suburban-dwelling consumer society. So whereas in Europe... Germany and Russia, okay, Russia is outside Europe, but it was part of our system of politics at the time. It was seen as offering a totalitarian vision of the future. America's vision of the future in the late 30s is this consumer future. And what they're saying, what they're offering here, and you have to remember, this is America that's just coming out of the Great Depression, where, you know, large, with mass unemployment, and there'd been a collapse in American industry, and it offered this utopian vision to the future. They also, interestingly, used the model of the motor car industry to actually propose the first vision of artificial intelligence. As you saw at the beginning, the Honda robot is called Asimo because it's named after Isaac Asimov, a science fiction writer who visited the 1939 New York World's Fair and was inspired to change the way that we thought about artificial beings. You know, from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein monster onwards, the artificial being, you know, was invented by the scientists and then turned round and killed the person who created it. It was a dangerous monster created by the scientist. He decided to flip it over and say, well, shouldn't it be seen like a motor car? And so this popular model of the 19th century, of the killer cyborg creation, was changed into this vision of a friendly robot. So in something like... if you think back to this Robbie the Robot, this is a direct descendant of the Electro and Sparko, which were put on by Westinghouse as a gimmick at this Futurama exhibition. As you can see, he had to do wonderful things like count to 10, distinguish between red and green, and light your cigarette. Idea, of course, this, you know, the idea of the artificial being was as equally as fantastical then as it was seen later on. But what's interesting is that the central prediction of the 1934 New York World's Fair, which is that Americans within 25 years would be living in the suburbs, driving cars and being in a consumer society, came true. So if you went to the 1964 World's Fair, you went on highways that looked suspiciously like those in the dioramas of Futurama and Democracy City. You were living in the suburbs, you had your washing machine, you had your television set. And so you could think that if you went to the 1964 World's Fair, you would think, since the imaginary future of 1939 had come true, therefore surely the 1964 imaginary future would come true. And that by 1980, at the very latest by 1980, we would be taking holidays on the moon, you would have free electricity, and you would have robot servants. You would have Robbie the Robot looking after your kids, cleaning the house, and so on and so forth. But the problem with this prediction was that whereas in 1939 the prediction of the future was based on a technology which had some use, which had its use value was explicit. Okay, it's an exhibition value, it's an ideological promise about what American consumer corporations could create, but it was something that could be realized. There was something there behind it. The differences in 1964 is that the imaginary futures being promised were actually designed to disguise the use value. So exhibition in 1964 was disguising the real use values of these technologies. That is, of rockets, of nuclear power stations and of computers. Because, of course, what they were doing, what these machines had been invented for, was killing millions of people. If you put together a computer, a nuclear power station, and a rocket, what you get is blowing up Leningrad, Moscow, Warsaw, Budapest, or Riga. Yeah, and vice versa, of course, them blowing up London, Washington, Paris, Berlin, and, of course, Brussels. So this, and the problem, so you have to think what, so these technologies, there was a real necessity to hide their use. So whereas motor cars in 1939 could be used in such a way, obviously, to big up the corporations and to big up the American government and what it was doing, they weren't denying actually what motor cars were used for. They were used to transport people around, and they mainly had a civilian use. In 1964, they had to hide the use of the technology itself. And this was because only a few years earlier, America and Russia had almost blundered into destroying the planet over their squabble over who should own the island of Cuba. Yeah, and so actually, and of course, the whole strategy of peace in the 1960s, and in fact, for as we know, from 1945 right up to 1989, was based on this balance of terror, of a continual arms race between the two sides, so that war became peace. And so the trouble is that this, of course, risked at every moment in destroying the entire planet. And in a moment of lucidity, American military strategists named this irrational form of irrationality quite correctly as mutually assured destruction, or MAD. So you have the reason why Exhibition Valley has to deny use value is because it's actually designed to hide technologies that are MAD. Yeah, you. So rockets, which I go to see as a seven-year-old, and I think, oh, isn't this is taking heroic astronauts into space, are actually rockets that take nuclear bombs to kill millions of people. When we go and see the fusion reactor, which promises cheap electricity, actually what nuclear power stations are nuclear bomb factories. And what computers are guidance systems which deliver these weapons to kill millions of people. And, of course, IBM, as a corporation, made its money and came out of this nuclear arms race. And so the first computer it ever created, which was widely sold, was called the Defense Calculator, and every copy was sold either to the US military or to a military armaments manufacturers. And secondly, its other great thing for the U.S. state was to actually build Strategic Air Command. This is the thing. This is the control room which would have run the nuclear war. Your graphic user interface that you use on your computer, your mouse, all these basic things that you use on your computer today were prototyped in the command and control system to fight a nuclear war with the Russians. Yeah. So IBM was creating this technology, and it created the technology to run the US military nuclear fighting capability. But if we can think about, you know, one of the reasons why things like moon tourism, despite Richard Branson's best efforts, sound so funny today, or free electricity seems weird after Chernobyl, you know, is that these things didn't happen. One of the interesting things about computers is that this imaginary future of artificial intelligence actually comes. The reason why we become more skeptical about it today is because something different happened. It's not that the computer sort of disappeared as a technology, but quite the reverse. It was the computer is the Cold War technology that escaped from the Cold War. And this is because the US military needed these computers not just to blow up millions of people or bomb Vietnamese peasants and all the other things they used them for, but also to run its bureaucracy, to pay the wages of the troops, to actually move around its supplies. And, of course, these sort of problems were also faced by corporations, and so computers very early on started to spin off into the private sector. And so this computer, which actually the first version was entirely designed and built for the US military, is actually sort of basically a storage device. It's probably got less in it than a CD-ROM. But it's called, as you can see, a giant brain that's strictly business. And this was an example of how these computers, you know, this is the 702 series, but the 701, as I said, was a military machine, how you could just adapt this, because large corporations face the same problem as the military. Now, the information economy, which we talk about as a new phenomenon, even still, I mean, at the Labour Party conference, which just took place the other week in England, one of the ministers gets up and says, "We are entering the knowledge economy," and actually, of course, large companies have been in the information economy for a long period of time. And in certainly, when as soon as large corporations were built in, were set up in the 19th century, and then obviously dominate the economy in the 20th century, what's usually now called Fordism, alongside mechanisation on the factory floor, you have to mechanise the office. And as you can see, these are controlling inventory, sales invoices of companies. And IBM started as a manufacturer of tabulators. It's the International Business Machines. That's what IBM means. And by the 1950s, the problem was that as though mechanization was proceeding very fast in the factory, it was lagging behind in the office. And so the classic thing in capitalism, which is to replace human labor with machine labor, was actually being held up because of the offices could not be mechanized in the same way as the factory floor. And so the computer came along at the right time, because you could replace whole offices with people using tabulators with this. With one of those funky System 360 high mainframes, so you can get rid of them, and have that, your new high-tech solution. Yeah, and this, of course, as I said, is the classic example of what to do in Fordism. That what the purpose of this is to use this machine not as a robot servant. If you remember back at the beginning, somewhere here, that what they're promising people in 1964 is every worker will have their own little robot servant. It will be our servant. It will look after us. It's our friendly machine. But actually, of course, what the bosses want is a computer that actually will control the workforce, that it's a machine that's designed not for us, but for them. And in fact, this is the top, as Norbert Wiener, who was one of the inventor of cybernetics, pointed out, that this idea of cybernetic feedback can be basically based on the Fordist idea, which is the knowledge of the rulers of the ruled, the panopticon, as Foucault would later popularize the idea, that what you have is a giant machine that supervises everything. And in fact, you get science fiction writers like Kurt Vonnegut in Player Piano imagining an entire economy run by a giant mainframe. And in fact, theorists like Herbert Simon, the person I talked about earlier on, who was predicting that the artificial intelligence would arrive by 1970, what Herbert Simon believed is actually the corporation and the mainframe would fuse into one thing, that you would have giant mainframes running all industry production. And so far from the robot being our servant, like Robbie the robot, this friendly person, it's actually the machine that dominates. It's the dominance of dead labour over living labour, of capital over workers, expressed in mechanical form. Now, of course, as I said, when people arrived at the IBM Pavilion, this version of artificial intelligence wasn't on show. It was seen as this friendly face. But, of course, to the managers who they were selling this to in the private sector, that's exactly what they were saying to them. You know, sack your office staff, replace your middle management with our mainframe. It's so much more efficient. So instead of having a room of chaotic workers who get sick and all the rest of it, get a giant machine that never takes a day off or goes on strike. But of course, Norbert Wiener, as a good lefty, pointed out that there was a flaw in this idea. This Fordist, he points out in here, Taylor being the father of scientific management, who thought workers should be nothing more than trained gorillas. That is, without any brains, that all intelligence should be sucked into management. He pointed out, of course, that feedback as a concept is actually much more powerful when it's two-way. That in fact it's something that works better, not when it's just information flowing upwards and orders flowing downwards, but when there's interaction between people, when it's a two-way flow of communication. And so we can see that in this sense, we can see that this version of computing, which is more to do with, I think, our present ideas of actually the more radical ideas around open source and network computing in general, is to see it as a more horizontal, two-way process, democratic process. So I said this version of how computers would use actually constructs a different version of computing. The imaginary future of artificial intelligence, obviously, for what was not this sort of version, which is actually using the computer to not to replace human beings, but to allow human beings to be more creative, to work together better, is not on IBM's program of the future. What it wants to do is to sell these machines to dominate and control people, either in military terms or in terms of business. Now, this, as I said, what's interesting about this is you can think about also how this creates a wrong, in a sense, artificial intelligence also comes out of a wrong view then of their technological future. Because what IBM was thinking is that computers would stay this size, and as they got better and better, they would become intelligent. But actually, of course, what happened actually was that computers stayed roughly the same and actually got smaller. So I use the word intelligence here as a metaphor, I hasten to add. So we can see, as my friend Graham says, that basically the System 360 is the same architecture as your mobile phone. In fact, your mobile phone is probably more powerful than the first System 360s. And of course, what's happened is that the room-sized computer has shrunk to something that you can put in your pocket. But what it hasn't done is become the artificial being, the silicon messiah. And so I want to conclude, the purpose of this, as I said, is to think about the future. If the purpose for me, I think, of looking at the history of the future is to first see that a lot of the futures that politicians, technology pundits and even scientists working in these areas is actually the same future. The future is what it used to be. The future is something, you know, it's a future that we're continually present. It's like communism was in the old Soviet Union. Communism was always 10 years, 20 years in the future, whether you lived in the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, until people eventually gave up, right, and realised that this system wasn't going to deliver communism. So I think that's one of the reasons why I think it's interesting looking at history, is to say that given what's happened in the past, and the fact that actually it's not just that it's a failed prediction, but it's actually a failure to understand what computers do. So one of the things that make computers powerful is not that they're going to create robot servants that will run around and look after us like Robbie the Robot or Electro. But actually, as I said, that they're tools that augment and help us be creative, allow us to network together, allow us to become collective in new ways, to create new social ways of being. And it's these sorts of sides of computing that, in fact, it's ideas like artificial intelligence are suppressing. And so if you believe that the purpose of computing is to bring the silicon messiah, the first coming of the silicon messiah, you're missing the point of what computers do. And if computers carry on getting smaller and smaller and disappear into almost things that we can wear, and that actually it will radically change the world in a different way than is put in this classic prediction of what computers are doing. And so this is the second part of this, is that one of the things that we ought to do is to invent new futures. You know, some imaginary futures come true, like the suburban dwelling car owning imaginary future of the 1939 New York world. So other imaginary futures haven't come true, and maybe we don't really want them to come true, because artificial intelligence, if we think about it in its corporate sense, is a vision of domination and totalitarianism. It's an idea of the factory dominating whole of society and controlling people. The digital panopticon is a very unpleasant future. And therefore, one of the purposes maybe of inventing new futures is to create, show us a way that we can develop not just technologically, but also socially and culturally in more creative, democratic, egalitarian and communist, maybe in the positive sense of the word. Okay, thank you. Bye.